Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. So the Tilburg Foundation is dedicated to a very simple proposition. We live at a moment when all of the big issues are global, which means all of the good solutions, if there are any, are going to be global. The contradiction is that most people want to think not globally, but locally. Nationalism is on the rise, not just in my country, the United States, in your country, Italy, in Germany, in France, in Japan, in China. That's why we're getting the wrong answers. So what we're trying to do with the Tilburg Foundation is look for different kinds of answers, which means you've got to look for different kinds of people. 10 years ago, we decided to, because of that thinking, to start something we call the Tilburg SNF Eliasson Global Leadership Prize. We decided that we ought to look for people around the world who are leaders in whatever space, from whatever country, who share some common values. Leadership requires courage. Leadership requires innovation, or it's not leadership. Based in ethics or universal values, so it's got to be moral, or it will not succeed. And it's got to be global. It's got to be predicated on the assumption that the world does need to look up, not down. So we started this prize 10 years ago, and every year we have 2 to 3 to 4 winners. We do a global search. It will start next month. It'll start in March, early March. We ask people around the world to nominate global leaders. Anybody anywhere can nominate a leader. Last year, we had 2,300 nominations from 140 countries, and then a long, elongated process, pre-jury, jury, AI doing some research, doing some help, that eventually produces 3 winners. We don't find these people. The globe finds these people. We then distill, think, and choose, but it's an open selection, and you're all welcome and indeed encouraged to think about who you know, maybe a professor, maybe a colleague, who's a global leader and we ought to consider, and that would be incredibly helpful. So this year we have, as I said, these 3 people chosen. Chris Olsen. Chris Olsen is a pediatrician, a doctor, and an innovator who's trying to understand how to make better health outcomes using technology with a base not just at Harvard, where he hangs his hat occasionally, but also in Uganda and India. And I'll let him explain why those different places and how that works. Maria Teresa Renderos, a Colombian journalist who has, among other things, pioneered the notion that in a digital age, we have to reinvent journalism, that we've lost in many countries, Italy as well, certainly my country, we've lost the notion that journalism is actually chasing facts and truth. We've got to do better in journalism. If we don't get journalism right, we will fail as we are failing in country after country with democracy. And Maria Teresa will expand on that more than a bit. And then finally, Fernando Trujillo, he is one of the world's expert on something I didn't know exist until I met him, river dolphins. Now, why do you want to be a world expert in river dolphins? He will tell you why. But the essence of the answer is that as a scientist, he begins studying a particular animal. He becomes expert in it, realizes it's an endangered species. How do you save an endangered species? Most people focus on the animal. His insight was, you got to focus on the community along the rivers. If you don't get the community on your side and understand what they need, they won't be part of the solution. To get them on your side, you got to figure out what their politicians want, because the politicians make the laws and the policies. So he worked up a food chain from scientist expert to community and river expert to governance, because at the end of the day, if we don't get the governance right, it all turns to dust. Three very different people. Two of them happen to be Colombian. Chris, why don't you expand a bit on what you do?
Thank you all for being here for this conversation. I'll tell you, it's so humbling to hear about this award and have been awarded one of these with these wonderful people. And you will hear how much intersection there is between the three of us. And even though we have such wildly different backgrounds, one thing I'll just start off by saying is, so I'm now based at Harvard University in Massachusetts General Hospital, and I do internal medicine and pediatrics, but I trained in tropical medicine in London. I trained in public health in Australia. And I should say I'm also a Colombian. I'm a British Colombian from
three Colombians.
So from the west coast of Canada, and am now based in Boston. But as we talk about the work that I've been so privileged to be a part of in low and middle income countries, and it is anything but us taking a great idea from Boston and trying to import it or impose it on communities overseas. In fact, it's really oftentimes the reverse. And I think that the globe now is disseminating knowledge like never before. But unless we recognize that the people who are faced with challenges in their own communities, who really understand them the best, and then if we don't kind of empower those people with a system to or a process to really solve their own challenges, we won't really come up with nuanced solutions that will be implementable, that really scale in their environments facing the challenges that they face. And so I've really seen communities from refugee camps on the Thai-Burmese border to Sudan and Ethiopia, and then more recently, since 2011, have started working in Uganda and India. And it truly is the process I'm talking about is I didn't have the language around it when we started, but I just had this notion that if we ask rather than impose, people will come up with a better solution. And so oftentimes people would look and sort of look surprised at you and say, oh, you're really asking. And they would say, oh yeah, this project that came from this grant, that'll never work. And I was like, oh, you know, like, why? What would you do differently? And when you ask people, it's amazing what they come up with. And so I'll just mention, it's so inspiring when people start solving their own challenges. So in just the first 5 years of doing this between India and Uganda, 100 projects that were novel ideas had already progressed to the point where they'd gotten human ethical approvals and were being trialed on patients or providers. 36 companies had started out of this in their own environments. And 23 of those companies were earning revenue. There was 48 patents filed. But we weren't only looking for stuff. So if a more elegant solution was just reimagining the process of giving care, we championed that as well. And I'll tell you, we learned so much about minimally viable products and really taking advantage from people that are faced with these challenges in a way that's informing how we deliver care in the United States. And how we listen to people who are really on the front lines of healthcare, and am not sort of making decisions centrally. And I think what we need to do is recognize that curiosity is the close cousin of creativity. And if we listen to the communities that we're wanting to live in this world with, we'll learn so much more. And one thing I like to say is myself, my colleagues, we've been the biggest benefactor of any exchange we've had in all of these settings.
Thank you. And takeaways, there's sort of two takeaways from that, which we will expand upon. One is, this is a guy who's doing both high tech and low tech, but he's not doing tech for tech's sake. It's all about outcomes. You don't actually care how you get the outcomes. You care that you get outcomes. And too much of what passes for leadership today is the blah, blah, blah. Oh, let's make noise. That's leadership. That's not leadership. It may be part of leadership, and it is the communications part, but outcomes matter. Maria Teresa.
Well, thank you. Thank you for this opportunity to meet you. Most of you are men. So this is a college of men, no? It's wonderful to be here. So what I do is we created with a group of friends the Latin American Center for Investigative Reporting. KIP, we call it the CLIP. And what we do is we organize and promote cross-border investigative reporting. So we get together with other media outlets, sometimes small, sometimes big, from different parts of Latin America, and sometimes even across borders. In Italy, we have worked sometimes with IRPI, the investigative outlet in Italy. And what we do is we investigate abuse of power. And what is abuse of power? When the government or a private organization or company or a criminal organization hampers or provides or creates obstacle for people like you to develop, to become better. So they take the money that it was supposed to go to health, and it doesn't go to health because they buy an apartment in Miami, or they contaminate a river where people like you are drinking the water. And so they're abusing their power to live, to create benefits for a small elite and not leaving a lot of people with opportunities. And that's basically what we do. We do investigations. We've already worked with about 143 partners, mostly in Latin America, but sometimes the stories take us abroad. And so we've done stories about migration, who benefits with these very strict prohibitive policies around migration, who is making the money there. We also investigate corruption across borders. We also investigate solutions, green solutions, to face and to confront climate change. How are they working really in real life? Because let's say an airline like Delta Airlines goes and buys carbon bonds because they think that's the way they can lower their impact on the environment because of the carbon emissions they produce in the airplanes. So they compensate by buying these carbon bonds. And who produces these bonds? The governments that say, okay, or the companies that say, we are investing, we are giving money to a community, indigenous community in the Amazon, and they're taking care of the woods. And so we give them money, and the amount of carbon that they keep the forest from not producing the carbon, that produces a bond. And so if you buy that bond, you're actually trying to stop to preserve woods and to preserve the forest and the jungle so you don't produce, it can suck the carbon from the atmosphere. This is the theory. So we went and did a lot of investigative reporting throughout many different jungles and in different countries to see if this was happening really. So that's exactly what we do. And so what is this like thinking in journalism in a different way? Because probably none of you read news in traditional newspapers. How many of you read news in traditional newspapers?
So we've got two.
So very little.
But, two old people, yeah, I was going to say
that. But you read whatever you're interested in, Instagram, in TikTok, in X, whatever it's called, Twitter or Facebook or whatever social network you use, or even just WhatsApp, or WhatsApping from whatever your friends send you as news. And so we cannot continue thinking we journalists are preaching to the world, telling them how what's happening, and when they're not there, they already left, the audience is left somewhere else. So we have to go where they are. And that means including, because you all produce information every day. You see something, you tweet it, you produce a lot of information. So if you're producing information and journalists think they have it all, they're just, it's a mix match. So what do we need to do as journalists? We need to include you guys. We need to include people who are producing information, who probably know more about many topics than we do. And what do? We put our methodology of verification of contrasting sources, our technology to make the search much, much faster. There is a field, a whole new field in journalism that's called open source investigative journalism that you can learn. Anybody can learn open source investigations. And actually, you can volunteer. There's lots of places where you can volunteer as open source investigators. And it's amazing the amount of information you can get openly in the internet. And so for the sake of democracy, we need, as Alan was saying, to reinvent journalism, to give it a new space to connect with people and create communities of production, and also to go cross borders, because things don't happen only in a country. Whatever Erdogan in Turkey decides is connected with what's happening in Europe, what's happening in Ukraine, what's happening in Russia. So everything is connected. Whatever my country decides has a lot of influence of religions, of that are cross-border, of information that is cross-border, of people who are specialized in disinforming or producing information that is not true. And they're specialized on that, and they're charging a lot of money to do that because they have an interest, economic or political. And so we need to know who they are and how they're working and how they're operating. So in this age of abundance of information, the only way to have an impact is to collaborate. We don't need to compete. We need to collaborate. And then the difference is the quality and the capacity to include ordinary people in the production of this information. So that's basically what we do. We provide a lot of support, technology, capacity to process loads of information. All of these to these teams that we form to investigate every one of the stories we do. So, yeah, I think that sums it up.
What do war lessons from Gaza, rethinking education, peace in Ukraine, and visionary leadership have in common? They are all themes from recent episodes of this podcast. Check out more episodes on TelbergFoundation.org or on a platform of your choice.
So my takeaway from that would be this concept of borders and barriers is just stupid. You don't grow up to be a journalist or a biologist or a physicist or an American or an Italian. Those borders are no longer relevant to how we act or how we think about the world. And the more you stay within, the more you swim in your own lane, the less swimming you're going to get done. I think more or less is that. That's what you said. Fernando.
Okay, well, I am...
Swimming was a way to get to the war.
Yes. I'm a marine biologist. I'm a National Geographic explorer as well. And I started my journey when I was 19 years old. I went for the first time to the Amazon with this romantic approach to save the river dolphins. But when I arrived to the Amazon, I understood that if I wanted to save the dolphins, I needed to protect the rivers. So all these paths become into a conservation effort for the rivers. So I started in a small scale, in a small town of indigenous, and I was looking at different kind of conflicts between the people, the dolphins, and other animals, jaguars. And there was a lot of problems in the Amazon, and I needed to understand what was about. So we are talking here about the largest tropical forest in the planet, 7 million of square kilometers, 9 countries sharing the Amazon basin. We have 50 million of people living in the Amazon now. 3.2 are indigenous. So they are very few in comparison with the big numbers of people. There are large cities in the Amazon. So for many of you, maybe you image and dream about the Amazon as a very pristine area of forest with indigenous living in harmony. And it's not like that. There are a lot of problems. There are deforestation. There are mercury pollution because the illegal gold mining. There are animal trafficking, logging, illegal logging. There are emerging cities, roads. So we already lost 1 million of square kilometers of the Amazon. So why the river dolphins became relevant to this? So we started to survey the rivers and we started to look all these problems. And we needed to connect the governments with the rivers. And we found that the dolphins create this empathy with people. They care about dolphins. Could be an anaconda, could be a caiman, but in this case was the dolphin. The dolphins have large movements. They are everywhere in the Amazon. So we started to put together all the problems. We create local solutions with the local people, with the indigenous people. We work now building fishery agreements. We are recovering some fisheries in some areas. And there were some conflict, for example, between fishermen and dolphins. They claimed that the dolphins were going to the nets and steal the fish. So we started to look the problem, and it wasn't the dolphin, it was the overfishing and the competition between the people as well. So we started to teach and to train the fishermen to take tourists, and the dolphins became a solution for many of these indigenous communities. So we needed to scale this. So we started to work between the governments. And the governments said, what? The dolphins are special. Why we cannot do the same for other species? And we explained it's about the rivers. It's about the wetlands. The Amazon River is producing the 20% of the fresh water of the planet. So we started 3 years ago with a conservation management plan with the governments of Brazil, Ecuador, Peru, and Colombia. And now we are working in a transboundary way. I'm the coordinator for the 4 governments of these management plans. But we wanted to be more ambitious, and we wanted to do something for the Asian river dolphins. There are river dolphins in Asia and also in South America. In all the rivers where there are dolphins, there are 1.6 billion of people. The 20% of the population of the planet share their habitat with dolphins. And most of these rivers in Asia are with a lot of problems. So we need to recover. So 1 year ago, we convinced the government of Colombia to invite the 14 countries in the world with river dolphins to sign a global declaration for the conservation of the rivers. So we scale all these problems at the political level, and we started to look for solutions. One of them was the creation of special areas regarding aquatic ecosystem, that is the Ramsar sites. The Ramsar sites are wetlands. All the countries, Italy has a lot of Ramsar sites, and the European countries as well, and South America. And there are areas where there are people and they are living, and the livelihoods of those people can be improved with management plans. And we are doing all this together. So we are restoring, for example, the forest with indigenous families. In a very small Ramsar site in the Colombian Amazon, we have planted already in the last 4 years more than 50,000 trees with more than 2,000 indigenous families. And we create something very interesting. It's called the Forest Library. The Forest Library is about the knowledge of the elderly people about the trees. Because when you are listening on the news about the fires and we are losing the Amazon, they say the size of the soccer ground. But what does it mean? For me, it's very important to understand that each tree has a special ecological service. Just to give you an example, in Germany, the whole country has 96 different species of ants. In Brazil, in just one tree, there are 97 species of ants. In just one tree versus one country. So each time we lost one tree, we are losing a lot of species and a lot of animals. So we are changing the thing to look at the deforestation with the local knowledge of the elderly people. And we are creating this new approach for conservation. So basically, it's not a story about dolphins. It's a story about the rivers. It's a story about the veins of the continent and how to preserve the fresh water. So we need to create these partnerships with the government, with the local communities, and work together with the integration of local knowledge and scientific knowledge. And this is all about. Thank you.
Thank you. And so my takeaway from that would be, you want to solve this problem. If you think only about this problem, you will fail, because it's really about this context and that problem. And you've got to reinvent how you're looking at the problem. If he was still trying to just say river dolphin, fish by fish by fish, there'd be a lot fewer of them. I firmly believe that leaders are made not by their successes, but by their failures. You learn almost nothing from success. You get prizes, you get pats, you get money, etc. You learn a hell of a lot from failure. So I want to talk a bit about failure, not success. And I'm going to ask each of you to share with us one big failure that mattered to how you evolved.
I couldn't agree more. In fact, I give a talk called The F Word about failure. And I think that you should always be asking your professors or people you respect, say, like, what really taught you? Because I think that's where wisdom comes from. One that I'll mention is, we came up working together a little bit in Cambodia, a lot in Indonesia and in India, with this challenge around newborn incubators and how they were often not working 3 months after being donated. Say Mete Premas are donated from France to Aceh after the tsunami. And so we wanted to come up with a sustainable incubator, and then really addressing it from a human-centered design standpoint, we came up with the issue that there were embedded service contracts where people had to come in and fix them every 3 months, and that was never going to happen, even aside from the fact that the instructions were in French. The other thing was the infrastructure in many of the hospitals didn't permit them to even be mobilized for brownouts and blackouts and inadequate power sources. So we came up with this idea of building a car part incubator where the replacement parts and the longevity of them were all built from Toyota car parts. We actually got a small grant and bought a functioning Toyota, and we like to say we took away all the parts that weren't an incubator and built this incubator. But when we'd finished with all of the inputs, we thought the ideas were fantastic. Two small women could carry it, lift it off its base, and take it up and down stairs, because lifts often wouldn't work in these hospitals. It was really run on a 12-volt battery, so it could last for 8 hours when the power was out. And there were things that in Boston, they were saying, if our incubator could do this, this would be great. And it was using the brake lights to signal when temperatures were were off, or the there was evidence the baby wasn't breathing right, and so they liked the visual, because they would go out into a newborn nursery and go to the wrong places. So this all sounds great, and it did to a number of people too. And I'll have to say, we got a number of international accolades for it, and I'm almost embarrassed to say one was in the Smithsonian's Design Museum. And I poured so much into it for about 5 years, from 2005 through 2010. And it was a total, utter failure. There was one baby that was in one of these devices, and that was one taken for an article in Time magazine as one of the 50 best inventions of 2010. It didn't save one baby or one life. And we can go into all of the reasons, but it was an incredibly humbling experience. And taking a step back from that, we just realized, you know, we had it wrong. We developed what was desirable, but we hadn't really considered entirely feasibility, what's possible. And then we didn't have people with the knowledge of how tenders work and the business knowledge of sustainability or viability. And it crushed us. A different one went into a medical innovation museum in Boston. And I would have to walk by it to my office, and I would drop my head and just say, please stop that display, because it was such a failure. And I think we learned so much of it that out of that, we said, like, our life is not about getting accolades. It's not about proving how right we are or how smart we are. It's about changing the world that we want to live into.
Some advice: when you ask your professor about his or her failure, blame it on him. Maria Teresa.
In my career, I've had many, many failures. I've started many companies and organizations, and a lot of them just didn't survive. One of the shortest was lasted 2 months, 3 months, really, and it didn't work. But what I want to tell you is a little bit more the recent ones, the ones that we've done with Clip. So one of them was regarding putting together one of these investigations. So we had published a story that was very, very successful. It was called Migrants from the Other World. And it was about migrants that came from Asia and Africa that would cross all across Latin America to make it to the U.S. or to Canada. And there's the stories of these people and who were bringing them, and how much it cost them, and how they were exploited, and how organized crime was influencing all of these processes. And so we had this big success, and then we were called by a big publishing house to publish a book about it. So we published a book. We were very excited about the whole process. So we said, oh, let's make another one. We're going to make another story about the Venezuelans. You know, the Venezuelans is this country that has expelled in the last 8 or 10 years, probably 8 million people from the country. And it's the only country not at war that has expelled so many people, basically because it has a terrible government that has destroyed the economy and the possibility of making a living in the country. So lots of people have left. So we said, oh, we're going to have this amazing story about the Venezuelans trying to reach the different countries in Latin America, but mostly the U.S., because a lot of them were trying to go to the U.S. And we had a very big team in Venezuela that wanted to collaborate, one of these media outlets, and we had partners throughout the region. And then we also, for the first time, got this amazing partner in the U.S., in the border. And we said, this is perfect. We're going to have a great story. And we had a meeting, and we had the permissions, and we had everything, and the how do you say, the commitments by the editors, especially the American editor, that was very important for us. And nothing happened. We would ask them for their first memos of reporting, nothing. We would try to call them and say, what happened? Why aren't you doing the story? Nobody was doing the story. We couldn't get them excited. And then we realized that we ourselves didn't have a clear story. We didn't have a reason. What is it that we're going to tell that's new? Everybody knew that the Venezuelans were going all over the place. So what's the story about? So we learned from that we really had to have a very clear vision into what is it that we want to tell that people don't already know. A lot of journalists tell the same story over and over again, and that's why it doesn't work. And we ourselves, we're not even excited about telling this story because we have clarity. Well, the story didn't work. It was a little bit of an embarrassment with the American newspaper because the first time we get them to be interested in one of our stories and they didn't, and it didn't go anywhere.
I think our main learnings come from the interaction with local communities. Because I just mentioned yesterday, we arrived with this arrogancy of the scientists coming from a university and we believe we know everything. And then you move in a very remote area like the Amazon and you realize you don't know nothing. And I remember when I just arrived and the indigenous didn't like very much the biologists and anthropologists. And I asked them why. And they said, you come here for a week or 2 weeks, collect information and then disappear, publish your results and never return. So I decided to stay in this small town. And so far I have been 37 years there. And I remember we were focused on the fisheries, because we wanted to secure the livelihood of people. So we went with the fishery authority of the government and we made a workshop with all the indigenous of the communities. And we say, look, we need some fishery agreements here to protect the lakes. And they say, okay. And we, the government and Omacha Foundation, my organization, we just gave them all the rules. And we asked them, are you agree? Yes. Okay. We were so happy. That was in 1992. And 2 days later, I went inside the lake and I saw a huge net. And I couldn't understand because everybody were in agreement. When I was approaching, was the mayor of the city that was an indigenous and also was the captain of the indigenous fishing together. And they have a forbidden fish in the canoe. So I take the fish, I look, I say hello, and I went away. That night, they come to my field station and they apologize. I say, no, you don't need to apologize with me. I need to apologize with you because we impose these rules. We are not convinced. And that's the arrogancy we have sometimes to produce the solutions from the cities and don't understand the local needs and the way they think. So 14 years ago, the indigenous approached to me and they say, you remember the fishery agreements in 1992? I say, yes, I am very ashamed with that. And they say, well, we want to do. And I say, okay, but in this time, we are just going to support you. And you are the ones to propose the rules. And this is the only way it can work. We also, as a Western, we did solutions very fast, quick. But the times of the local people are different. So we need to understand this. And those are the main failures because we want to impose things. So if you are working with local communities, you need to understand them, you need to live there, and try to be strategic. Sometimes good intentions are not good enough.
We have sitting here a doctor, a journalist, a scientist. But it's about leadership. It's not about medicine. It's not about journalism. It's not about science. It's about leadership. And I think over the last hour and a half, you've seen why the Telberg Foundation honored these three people for their leadership. Not because, and they happen to be very good doctor, journalist, and scientist, but it's about the connectivity. It's about the stuff that makes them leaders, as you've just heard. And all I can add in conclusion is someday you guys are going to be sitting up here, recognized as leaders, not because you become a great business person or because of great this, it's because you learn how to be a leader. So thank you very much. I appreciate your joining us, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation with them. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.